Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today, live and local, is Clark Lombardi, the University of Washington Law Foundation Professor of Law at, you guessed it, the University of Washington. Go Dogs! He also holds the title of Director of Islamic Legal Studies, as well as being an adjunct professor of international studies in the Jackson School of International Studies. These titles would tend to speak for themselves, it would seem. Professor Lombardi holds a law degree and a PhD from Columbia University, where he was a James Kent Scholar in the law school and a President's Fellow whilst pursuing his doctorate in religion. He also earned a bachelor's degree from Princeton University, majoring in religion. Clark did his time in lawyerly duties as a clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, as well as working with the firm of Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen, and Hamilton in the Big Apple. He is the author of numerous articles covering the topics of Islam, democracy, constitutional politics, and Sharia law, many of which you can find on his Social Science Research Network page. And he has also edited or authored several books, including State Law as Islamic Law in Modern Egypt, the Incorporation of the Sharia into Egyptian Constitutional Law, Religion and Human Security, and the Oxford Encyclopedia of Islam and Law. We always link to the biography and works of our guests, and this will be no exception, so please visit us over at www.researchonreligion.org to dig deeper into the subjects we will be talking about today. Clark, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. We've had lawyers on our program before. We've had lots of professors and people who have degrees in religion, but I think you might be the first to combine all three of those aspects into one awesome burrito of professionalism. So the obvious question is, how does one start out studying religion at Princeton, end up in law school at Columbia, determine that law school isn't enough, and then pursue a doctorate, whew, and then you end up teaching at the university that has the best football team west of the Mississippi? How's that all happen?
Well, you know, Oliver Cromwell once said, "He goeth furthest who know not whither he goeth." And that has always been a mantra for me. It actually was on my college yearbook page. So this hasn't all been planned out. But I've been interested in the question of religion and politics, broadly speaking, religion and social organization, how religion helps to both organize people and then to create sort of individual fulfillment within society. And that's been something that's fascinated me since the time I was an undergraduate. And the research that I've done has sort of flowed out of that. After college, I taught in Indonesia for a couple of years. I was teaching at a Muslim university. I found Islam incredibly interesting. I'd studied some Islam as an undergraduate. And when I came back, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to go on in law or whether I wanted to go do a doctorate in religion. And Columbia suggested I do both. And so that seemed too good an opportunity to pass up. So that's what I did. So I actually did the two simultaneously. It wasn't choosing to do one and then do another. I actually chose to do essentially a joint degree. When I came out, I figured there'd be no jobs and for someone who was interested in the kind of things I was interested in. So I went to practice law for a couple of years and pay off my loans. And then it became clear that people were interested in Islam and politics. And so one of the schools that was most interested was the University of Washington. So I came out here.
Very cool. I have to ask, how was the time in private practice in law, either with the firm that you work for in New York City or more interestingly, clerking at the Supreme Court? That sounds kind of like a cool job.
Well, I should be clear. I clerked for now Justice Alito when he was a circuit court judge. So I wasn't on the Supreme Court. I was at the Third Circuit Court of Appeals before he was elevated. But I loved practicing law. And one thing that was interesting to me when I was studying law is to realize how much it helped me understand, I think, or at least to read in a different way than my colleagues read Islamic law. People are coming out of a religion program and read Islamic law. I don't think always appreciated the very legal aspect of the writing. There's very interesting similarities between the way that 12th century Baghdadis write and 21st century New Yorkers write about law. So I loved practicing law. I really did enjoy it. I liked having clients, but eventually the call of the academy was too much.
Yeah, and we are so glad to have you here at the University of Washington, which is really cool. And teaching in law school, I guess that's kind of a natural home for you then, too. If you like practicing law, you like academia, you're kind of combining the best of both worlds by teaching in law school.
Well, you know, my job really is the best of both worlds because I teach U.S. constitutional law, and I do have a lot of JD students, but I also teach seminars that draw PhD students and master's students in area studies or in religion or politics. So I really get a very diverse set of courses to teach, and I just love it.
All right. Well, I have been pursuing you as a guest for several years now. You've been suggested by several students that you've had that I should get you on the program, and our schedule's finally clicked up here, so that's good. And your appearance today is quite timely given recent events in Turkey, which we might have you pontificate about at the end of our discussion. For those of you who are not in the know on current events, there was an attempted military coup in Turkey a few weeks back. And I should note that we are recording this on August 11th, with it airing in late August, because history or current events can be rather fluid at times. So just so you know the context that we're in. And Turkey has long been hailed as an Islamic nation that has settled into a reasonably stable democratic pattern over the past few decades, although the recent crackdown by the Erdogan government in response to the military coup does raise a few concerns on that front. Now, as mentioned, we'll get you to reflect upon some of this at the end of the interview, but I think the bigger issue that all of this suggests is the ability to reconcile Islam with democracy. Is that the big issue here?
Well, I don't think so. Turkey's problems with democracy don't necessarily. In fact, I don't think they have a lot to do with Turkey's history with Islam, although, of course, some people disagree. Turkey had a secularist government that was rigidly authoritarian for many years, and most of the coups that have come about in Turkey have been by secularist political actors. So I think one has to separate out the fact that Turkey is a majority Muslim country from the fact that it has problems with democracy. And in Turkey, as in many countries, Islam creates a vocabulary of ethics and a vocabulary of politics, and that vocabulary can be used by different people for different ends. There certainly are very illiberal and undemocratic actors in Turkey who speak in an Islamic idiom, but there are also democratic actors who speak in an Islamic idiom. And in fact, President Erdogan's government, when it first came to power and really did go in its early years in a period of liberalization and democratization, that was quite striking. And it had always had an Islamic, if not an Islamist, bent. And a lot of people suggested that this proves to us that under certain circumstances, at least, Islam can be compatible with democracy.
So what we want to do is turn to Sharia law, because that is what you've written on recently, and it's fascinating. We throw that term around out here in the West quite a bit, but I'm not sure everybody knows what Sharia law is explicitly. So let's start off with just a basic question. What is Sharia law?
Well, you know, Sharia law, let's take out Sharia law, and because that muddies the waters a bit, and talk about the Sharia. The Islam is a religion that is deeply concerned with proper practice. It's deeply concerned with ethics, ethical behavior. To be saved, one has to behave ethically, and the Quran is very clear on that point. And in one verse, it says, we've created a path for you, the Sharia, and Sharia means path. We've created a path for you, so walk on it. And so the term Sharia refers at some level to ethical behavior. And to follow the Sharia is to behave ethically in all aspects of one's life. So early on, Muslims began to explore the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad and the teachings of reason and a whole raft of indicators that they thought could help them understand how to behave ethically. And they began to construct books, and different scholars had different views about exactly what ethics would require, but they began to come up with vast teachings about what people should do in their private life in order to be saved. And then a larger question appeared, which is, well, okay, what if there's a whole community? What if people disagree? What should be the law that unites people? And Muslim societies began to develop bodies of law that were informed by the ethical speculations of these scholars. And so you had two things going on simultaneously. One is a set of teachings to individuals about what you as an individual should do, and the other is a set of laws that governments were creating that were informed by scholars' understandings of ethical behavior and tried to organize society in a way that was consistent with God's command. And so Sharia is both a way of living in all of its aspects, what you eat, who you marry, how you greet people in the street, and it also involves, it can also include a set of rules that communities as a whole are supposed to follow.
Okay. In terms of the development of the law specifically, and we kind of think about that in the framework of our Western legal system, how does Sharia law differ, or is it similar to, say, Catholic canon law or common law or regulatory law? How would you put that in the broad categories of law?
Well, you know, canon law is interesting. I was just at a conference on medieval canon law, and there are ambiguities in the concept of Catholic canon law that are quite similar to the ambiguities that exist with respect to Islamic law. Canon law both includes a set of, you know, teachings about what you should do and how you should behave in order to be saved, what penances you should do if you violate God's law in order for you individually to be saved. And then canon law also includes a set of rules that can be applied in courts that will regulate whole communities. The common law also is quite interesting, because the common law, insofar as it's the customs, you know, the inherited customs of the English-speaking peoples, has a strong grounding in Christian law and in canon law in certain areas. But it's come also with as common law has developed and sort of faced new situations that require practical responses, common law has developed rules that are only tangentially related to Christian ethical precepts. And in fact, right now, it's mostly a set of rules that are only hazily related to any religious principles. Sharia law, in the same way, you have some countries that apply Sharia laws that are directly in which the law itself is justified and directly linked to Scripture. But you have some countries that are applying Sharia law, by which they mean a law that is consistent with the broader principles of the Sharia, in which the rules have been developed in a way that's very practical and are designed to address practical concerns. And so the immediate justification for the law will be the practical needs of society plus a belief that God wants societies to structure themselves in a practical way.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of things does Sharia law cover? I mean, canon law tends to focus on religious things, but it can bleed into secular topics. Is same thing with Sharia law? Does it cover everything from, as you say, ethical living principles? You know, you'd think of murder and how you treat your neighbor and things like that, but also to property rights and regulatory stuff?
Yeah, the Sharia covers everything, because you're expected to behave in every way in every respect in an ethical fashion. So a Muslim who is concerned to make sure that she or he acts ethically may ask a scholar for advice. How does God feel about my daughter's decision to wear makeup? Or does God want my children to have a curfew? Or how does God feel about my eating a particular type of food? That's going to be covered by Sharia law, But if you go to a country that is applying what positive Sharia law, the law of the state that it defines as Sharia law, then as in any state, it's going to be selective. The governments regulate the things that governments are concerned with. And so the government of Iran has enforceable rules for certain issues, and in others it simply tells people there is a Sharia answer, and if you're going to have to figure out what it is for yourself in consultation with your spiritual advisor.
Now, one of the things that we oftentimes confuse out here in the West is we talk about Islam as it's like a one type of, or one religion, kind of like Catholicism. But Islam is pretty diverse, and we know about Sunni and Shiite differences. I would imagine that Sharia law has its differences as well. So if you could cover some of those and also kind of talk about the historical development of Sharia law over the past few centuries.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Sharia law is extraordinarily diverse, and Islam has been very, not only very tolerant, but very supportive and encouraging of contest and disagreement over questions of ethics, with the belief that if the community debates ethical questions and intelligent, committed people are arguing with each other over questions of ethics, sooner or later society is going to come up with a better answer. So you have a couple of levels of difference. One is between different sects. So the Sunni communities have their own laws, and Shia communities have their own laws. So one has to, you know, make sure that one understands that where there are different sects, there's going to be different laws. But what's more interesting to many people is that within Sunni communities and within Shia communities, there is enormous disagreement and contest over ethical questions, over what God has commanded. And again, as I said, this kind of contest is encouraged. So the Sunni law developed, or the law that we now call Sunni law, began to develop in the 8th and 9th centuries when a group of scholars waded into enormous contest over what's the proper method of looking for God's command. And they proposed an answer that was highly compelling to an enormous number of Muslims at that time. And their answer was one has to look for God's command in Scripture. So one thing that they eliminated was the possibility of charismatic interpretation. God had stopped, you know, giving people special insight, and there'd be no more prophetic prophetic announcements of law. So one had to look at Scripture, and then one had to, when one interpreted Scripture, one had to apply extremely complicated hermeneutics, and then one had to think about how to use analogy and Greek logic and Greek logical tools to expand upon the rules that one found in Scripture in order to come up with a set of rules that would be consistent not only with rules announced in Scripture, but with larger ethical principles that were implicit in the Scriptures. It's an extremely complicated, extremely sophisticated method of interpretation. And one needed so much training to do it that the scholars basically took for themselves the authority to say what God wanted you to do. The scholars, however, agreed to disagree among themselves about what it was that God wanted people to do, and it was understood that equally well-trained scholars using the same method might sometimes come to different conclusions. They might interpret a scriptural command differently. They might understand in different ways the method by which a scriptural command should be applied in very different circumstances in a later date. And so over time, competing interpretations of God's law appeared. And all were considered to be orthodox. And by orthodox, it meant that no Sunni Muslim who followed one school of law was allowed to call a Muslim who followed another school of law a heretic. So long as somebody followed a set of rules that had been developed by properly trained scholars using orthodox methodology, then God would respect them for following the law as they understood it. So this led to, you know, enormous tolerance of diversity, and it led to enormous diversity. So the challenge then came to be, if you're the ruler of a Muslim state and the religion, in theory, says that we can't know for sure what God wants you to do, and every individual has a right and a duty to follow the law as they best understand it. Well, how can you get people to work together? How can you create a common set of rules for criminal law or rules for contracting? And this was a huge challenge for Muslim political thinkers and political philosophers. And it continues to be one. So some of the debates that we see in the Muslim world today, if you look at groups like Islamic State or various Islamist thinkers as opposed to Islamic liberal thinkers, you're seeing arguments not so much about whether there's a diversity of possible answers to what God wants you to do, but there are arguments about what's the role of the state in selecting one answer and imposing it upon people. And this is what I find so fascinating. I study it both in the answers that medieval scholars came up with and that they are comfortable with, and I also study in the modern world how modern Muslims are struggling to come up with their own answers.
Yeah, if there's anything, governments like to have that one rule and not have disagreements like, well, you know, this guy said I can drive 80 miles down the freeway. This other one says 55. I can pick my own. And governments like to have that one speed limit set, essentially.
Well, they do. And as with the rise of the regulatory state, I mean, I think we keep forgetting how weak states were until the modern era. So you know, actually for many years, most governments really weren't particularly concerned about the speed limit. And it's only with the increasing power of the state in the modern era and the increasing desire for control that we see, you know, starting in the In the modern period, that governments have ever bothered to try and regulate things like the speed limit.
One of the things I'm interested in, you were talking about this, is that you had trained scholar jurists who would be making interpretations of these laws dating back to the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries. How did one get to be one of these folks? I mean, it's again, there's no central accrediting clearinghouse in Islam. So could anybody just say, well, you know, I got a degree from this school or something and I get to interpret law the way I want to? How was that negotiated back then?
In the medieval, what appeared were guild-like organizations. So and this again in pre-modern societies is, you know, more common than I think we realize. We don't really study guilds and how they work today. But you had guilds of scholars who in which there were scholars who recognized each other as properly qualified, and each one would undertake to train other scholars. And if they liked what their students and protégés had done, then they would give that their student or protégé a license to which accredited them in their own name. So Scholar A would say, I, Scholar A, have trained this person, and I'm comfortable that he has the ability to answer questions in the following subjects. And you'd get this license to opine on subjects, and you would carry it with you. And you would go to another city, and you would find people who were aware of your who knew about your teacher, and you'd say, this teacher gave me this license, and that would suffice as a suffice essentially as a diploma. So it's not centralized, but it works and it's organized.
Mm-hmm. In many ways, like having a Columbia Law degree gives you, you know, a certain panache in terms of, you know, I can practice law. You do have to pass a bar exam. But, you know, the degree itself, you know, kind of speaks for itself.
Yeah, and people who had trained with particularly reputable scholars did get extra credit in the eyes of the people. But ultimately, and this is interesting, the power of a scholar was dictated by the public itself. If people came to ask a particular scholar for his opinion, then he became well known as the kind of person, and his opinions were collected, and because his opinions were collected, his opinions would be read. So you get a certain amount of you get a certain amount of credentialing from the person you trained with, and after that you've got to make your own way.
Yeah, in many ways just like academia now. So very interesting. Let's talk about the state regulating Sharia rules here. And there's a couple things that as the state becomes bigger and bigger, more tension is going to arise that we talked about a little bit earlier. You talk about two different aspects of this state regulation of Sharia, and I'm going to pronounce this wrong. You better at pronouncing this. It's something called the Siyasa Shar'iyya.
Is that Siyasa Shar'iyya?
Okay. That's what is that? And pronounce it again so we can get it correct.
Okay, so it's Siyasa Shar'iyya, and Siyasa is statecraft. It's governance. So one might think of it as the rules that the government creates. At some level, it's like positive law. Sharia is an adjective, and it comes from it's comes from the root sharia. So it is effectively statecraft that is consistent with the sharia. And what the scholars over time began to commit themselves to. So you began to get consensus on the idea that the ruler had the right to engage in statecraft, and in fact had the duty to engage in statecraft, because God wanted Muslim societies to thrive, and because societies could not thrive without some set of common rules, the ruler was expected to come up with some common rules. But those common rules had to be shari. They had to be consistent with the sharia. And the answer, the majority answer, the answer that most Sunni Muslims grew to be comfortable with, was that an act of statecraft, a positive law, an act of siyasa, was going to be shari. It would be consistent with the sharia if it did not command Muslims to sin, and it was in the public interest. And each of those then was further elaborated. So the command that the rule that, or the principle that an act of positive government regulation must not command Muslims to sin meant, for all practical purposes, that it would not force Muslims to do something that all the schools of law agreed was unethical or forbidden. And that in turn tended to translate to did not force people to do something that the scriptures clearly prohibited them from doing. The question of whether a law was in the public interest was a bit more complicated, because it was rooted in not only in sort of utilitarian calculations, which the ruler was understood to be best suited to answer, is this going to actually promote the economy? But Islamic legal philosophy also argued that God wants societies to enjoy particular outcomes that are favorable to God. Certain social situations are situations that God favors, and all laws should tend to promote one of those favored outcomes. And so when scholars determined whether or not a ruler's behavior was consistent with the public interest, it had to not only be something that made people happier or seemed intuitively to promote the public interest, but scholars would also have to check to make sure that it promoted the types of social outcome that God wanted to be promoted and didn't promote the ones that got disfavored.
Okay. So let's move this into the more modern period and the formalization of bringing Sharia law into constitutional governance. And constitutional governance is relatively new on the historical scene. And as soon as a number of Islamic majority countries begin to write constitutions, the issue of how to incorporate the Sharia becomes an issue here. As you're writing this down on paper, it's going to be somewhat formalized. And you have written quite a bit about something known as a Sharia guarantee clause in some of the constitutions that have recently been drafted. What are these things, and what is usually included in these? Is it just about content, or are there procedural issues involved as well?
Well, it's a great question. This is a fast developing area in the Muslim world. The first constitutions that appeared in the Muslim world were not what many of us would think of as constitutional lists. So by that, what I mean is the earliest constitutions in the Muslim world generally said who's in charge, and everyone has to obey them. And sometimes, you know, and sort of identified who was in charge, how succession would take place, maybe, you know, allotted certain types of responsibility to certain government bodies. But basically, it was a blueprint for, you know, for managing power and not for constraining power. What you have in the earliest constitutions are, in many cases, an intriguing thing where basically the Constitution says the emperor or the king is in charge, and they're going to govern with the assistance of certain regulatory bodies, and the king and the regulatory bodies are all going to take oaths that they'll act in a way that's consistent with the Sharia. And that's how you know that they're good people and you have to trust them. It's a very, very basic basic structure. But it builds within it the idea that government legitimacy is going to be rooted in the government's willingness to abide essentially by the principles of siyasa sharia, that the government is going to – has the right to govern so long as its commands are going to be shari. They're going to be ethical and they're not going to command Muslims to sin, and they're going to be in the public – promote the public interest. One thing that changes particularly it changes after the Second World War, is people begin to think that constitutions shouldn't only identify who's in charge, but they should also actually create some rules that are going to create constraints on power. And this is the whole idea of, you know, you have rights guarantees, you may have parliamentary systems in which the ruler is now checked by a democratically elected parliament. There's a whole range of new ideas come about, and these start getting put into constitutions. And when this happens, you begin to see some people say, all right, well, you know, as we're trying to identify the constraints that are going to exist on this government, we want to be really explicit. The government has to respect certain fundamental rights. So most constitutions in post-war constitutions in the Muslim world have bills of rights or rights guarantees in them. But increasingly, a lot of them said, and we also want to make explicit this idea that the government should act in a way that's consistent with the Sharia, that government laws are going to be Shari. And so they include not only bills of rights, but they also include within them provisions, which may be very short, which say, and the government has to, all government laws have to not only respect rights, but government laws also have to be consistent with the Sharia. And they tend to not be more specific than that, which means that states having enacted this kind of constitution are going to have to create institutions and develop bodies of discourse to try and understand in the modern era what does it mean for a modern law to be consistent with the Sharia, to be Shari. And also to try to understand, and how does the command that the law respect the Sharia relate to the command that the law respect, for example, freedom of speech or democratic principles? And different countries have come up with different institutions, and different countries have come up with different, you know, substantive answers to those questions. And it's a very interesting thing to see.
So one of the things that is going on in the world, constitutional governments becoming a big thing in the late 19th century, early 20th century, that's the time of the Ottoman Caliphate. And then the Ottoman Caliphate disappears in a coup in the early 1920s with Ataturk coming to power. Was the Ottoman Empire playing around with constitutional government and thinking about how to more formally incorporate Sharia law at this time? And then what happens when Turkey essentially, quote unquote, goes secular?
Well, the Ottoman government was a very interesting one because it was very bureaucratic. It was very early on, it was a bureaucratic and well-defined governmental structure. And actually, in the Ottoman Empire, although it didn't have a constitution, there were implicit principles and there were institutions that had been developed that were created specifically to ensure that these implicit principles were respected. And the principles included principles that the Ottoman Sultan would have to rule in accordance with the Sharia. So when the Ottoman government began to modernize and began to think, okay, like, you know, as it looked to Western nation states and looked at some of the ways that they were structuring themselves and the things that they did to maintain power, they saw that these Western nation states were often creating constitutions, which made it, which sort of made explicit how power was to be exercised in the state, and therefore helped to both to build popular buy-in, but also let people know who was in charge. So, so constitutions seemed to be a pretty useful technology. And the Ottoman government did, in fact, enact a constitution, but it was a pretty – the first one was quite straightforward. It was the king is in charge. The king will rule in consultation with various bodies that had already existed in the past, and the king will take an oath to respect the Sharia. Over time, as when Ataturk – or just before Ataturk took power, there was a real constitutionalist push to try and make the Ottoman constitution a richer and more detailed document, and one that would create some constraints on the Ottoman state, as well as simply identifying the sultan as the person in charge. And that movement eventually got short-circuited by the Turkish Revolution that led to the rise of Ataturk, and Ataturk was a militant secularist. And so when he took over, not only did one see the absence of provisions requiring the state to act in accordance with the Sharia, but one actually saw a principle of secularism enshrined in the constitution, which has continued to be there to this day, even as personally pious leaders like Erdogan and political parties made up primarily of personally pious people are becoming incredibly powerful in the country.
Mm-hmm. Is this happening also extensively in the mid-20th century? We see a wave of secular governments, your Nasser governments, your Ba'athist parties rising after World War II in the area. Are they distancing themselves from these Sharia law guarantees, or are they embracing them? What's happening in the mid-20th century?
Yeah, what happens is these Sharia guarantee clauses, as I call them, but these provisions that say explicitly the state has to act in accordance with Sharia principles, they really don't appear. There's one in Iran in the early 20th century. There's some in Afghanistan. There are a couple scattered around here and there. But basically, the way it works is early constitutions are saying who's in charge, and in many cases, the person who's in charge has a title that defines them as an Islamic ruler, or they may be required to take an oath that they will, that they'll act in accordance with God's command. And there are all these implicit ideas in the Constitution which say that you have to follow this person, but by the way, they understand that their legitimacy is rooted in respect for Islam. And it's at a very vague level. Then with the rise of nation states after in a post-colonial nation state, so after decolonization and after the Second World War, or a little bit before, you begin to see a lot of constitutions come in which the Constitution doesn't say anything explicit about religion at all. And that's for a whole lot of reasons. Sometimes it's because these constitutions were basically drafted in consultation with a former colonial power, and the colonial power had no interest in empowering Muslims. Sometimes it's because the new constitution was closely tied to an ideology that was in tension with religious ideology, and so things were just kept very vague. And it's only with the rise of Islamism in the 1960s and 70s that you begin to see an explosion of constitutions that begin to say, this idea that was sort of implicit in early constitutions, or that people pussyfooted around in the middle, we want to make it explicit. We're going to put in, we've had all these bills of rights, and we're comfortable with those. We've created courts to enforce them, and now we want to also make explicit in our constitution that the government has to respect Islamic principles when it legislates or when it governs. And this really begins to pick up speed in the 60s and 70s, and it's continuing today. They're spreading all over the world.
And you've written extensively about this, and we'll point people back to your Social Science Research Network page so they can actually see some of the articles. One of the ones that's very interesting is you talk about how these SGCs, these Sharia guarantee clauses, are applied. And it's not just easy to just sit down and write them in there. You talk about three different broad methods of trying to put these into constitutions, such as political constitutionalism, legal constitutionalism, and then something else you call a hybrid that's somewhere in between those two. What are those three methods in general? And if you could give us some examples of different countries and how they've applied them differently.
Yeah, the one has to separate out two things. One is the basic idea that the state should respect Islamic principles, whatever those are, from the way in which the state is going to identify the principles that it has to respect and ensure that it complies with its obligations. And the point that I make in that article that you're talking about, I think, is that we can really draw an analogy here between the challenge of states when they think about how to create a constitution that not only says you have to respect Sharia, but creates institutions that are going to enforce it. That we can draw an analogy between their challenge and the challenge of liberal states. Because liberal states historically have put into their constitutions a Bill of Rights. They've listed a set of liberal rights that the government has to respect. But these liberal rights are themselves highly contested. You know, the U.S. Constitution and the German Constitution both guarantee freedom of speech, but they're very different ideas in the U.S. and Germany about what sorts of speech deserve that protection, how far can it go, what sorts of risk to the state must you be willing to tolerate in the name of freedom of speech. And within the United States, there's a range of, you know, there's a range of views about how much speech we should protect and how broadly. And in Germany, the same thing. Well, in Muslim countries, you have a very similar situation. And again, you know, as we talked about early on in this podcast, Islamic societies have tended to be enormously tolerant of disagreement about what the Sharia commands. In fact, it's encouraged contest and debate about what the Sharia commands on the assumption that if you get more contest, society eventually will be better off. We'll come, you know, we'll be able to recognize, you know, good answers. And so in that type of environment, if you write into your constitution a provision that says the state not only has to respect freedom of speech, about which we'll debate, but it also has to respect the Sharia, about which we have been debating for 2,000 years, then you're going to have you're not actually going to know where you're going to end up. All you're doing is making a commitment to respect principles that are being highly contested. Right. So the article points out that in liberal democracies, there's been a lot of discussion of late about what sorts of institutions are best suited to interpret and enforce rights guarantees. In the U.S., we just assume it should be courts, but actually that's an outlier. In many countries, it hasn't been courts that are trusted to say what the term freedom of speech means and to make sure that you're you get it guaranteed. In Britain, for example, you had a doctrine of parliamentary supremacy. So if the parliament enacted a law, the courts weren't permitted to strike it down and to say it was void. The parliament was supreme. And so it was going to be the people speaking through their representatives who were going to define the contours of freedom of speech. And the British trusted political mechanisms rather than judicial mechanisms. They just thought that over time, in sort of the Google theory, that if everyone sort of weighed in on a particular matter and was vested in the interest and voted and got, you know, and got their views heard, that society would come up with a better answer than you would if you appointed a couple of, you know, pointy-headed scholars to try and argue with each other about what freedom of speech meant. All right, so that's the world of political constitutionalism. Now, again, in the U.S., for a whole range of sort of complex reasons, a different answer came about, and the U.S. has the U.S. Constitution explicitly guarantees a range of liberal rights, and it doesn't trust the political forces to define what they are. It says that courts are going to have a veto power. If the U.S. Congress, you know, enacts a law and the president signs it and a group of expert, you know, legal experts serving as judges decide that this is inconsistent with the freedom of speech, then those legal experts sitting as judges can strike it down. There's two totally different ways of understanding how to what institutions should define, you know, should debate and define what these constitutional limits on the state mean and impose them. And it's the and the first is political constitutionalism. You trust the political branches to do it. The second is legal constitutionalism. You trust lawyers who've been appointed as judges to do it. And then recently there's been interest in countries that seem to combine elements of political and legal constitutionalism. And one of the ones that I talk about in the article is a method of what's called weak judicial review. And in that, judges are permitted and indeed required to review laws for consistency with the Constitution. If, for example, in Canada, you believe that a government law is inconsistent with your fundamental rights guarantees, you can, as in the U.S., go to court, and the court will review it, and the court may strike down that law. But what's different in Canada is, at least with respect to these rights guarantees, that the parliament does have the authority to explicitly override a judicial ruling. Now, it's got to go this is a politically sensitive thing to do, and it has to take the time to have a debate and have people say, yes, I know that all these experts reviewed this and found it inconsistent, and we just disagree with them. It has a political cost to do that, but they still have the power to do it. And so these are what situated systems like that, and there are a whole range of other sort of variations on this, are sort of hybrid. They've got an element in which judges do have a role in reviewing and interpreting guarantees, reviewing laws for consistency with them, and if necessary, opining that the law should be struck down. But judges don't have the final say, and the political branches also have a role in defining the two. And so in this article, I talk about the fact that, interestingly, although discussions about political constitutionalism and legal constitutionalism and hybrid constitutionalism have taken place almost entirely in the context of discussions about liberal rights, if you look in the Muslim world, you'll begin to see that similar debates are taking place with respect to the question of how do we interpret and enforce this Sharia guarantee clause. And you see some countries that say, well, you know, when it comes, people disagree about what the Sharia is, and, you know, for the purpose of making sure that the state respects the Sharia, then, you know, I trust the political branches to make the decision. Others have said, no way, we trust, you know, only trust legal authorities to do it. And I argue that maybe more of the states than have yet done so, maybe they should start looking at hybrid constitutionalism. It's worked in – it has some advantages in some liberal constitutional settings, and maybe it may have some advantages in some Islamic settings.
Give us some examples of where this has been applied, say, for political constitutionalism with the Sharia guaranteed clauses and legal constitutionalism, and then wrap up with some hybrid ones that have worked pretty well.
Well, as I said, hybrid constitutional, hybrid Islamic constitutionalism is largely unexplored. I give some, you know, in the article I point out that there's some things that look like they may be inching slowly in that direction, but it's precisely, you know, it's the call for the papers to say that maybe we should see more experimentation than we've seen yet. In terms of political constitutionalism, you're going to see this, for example, in any constitution in which there's no constitutional court, right? Because there simply is no. And there were many constitutions in the Muslim world in which courts simply did not have the power of judicial review. They looked like England or like many European countries before the Second World War. So the constitution says the state must act in a manner that's consistent with the Sharia, but there is no there's no court that has the power to enforce that constitutional command. That's always going to be a situation of political constitutionalism by definition. But in some cases, you have countries that have explicitly made questions of Sharia compliance. The constitution will say the state has to respect Islamic principles, the state has to respect the Sharia. And then the constitution will say, and by the way, even though there is judicial review, judges are not empowered to interpret and apply this. So Pakistan, for years had had a series of principles that the state was expected to respect that were declared in the Constitution itself to be non-justiciable, to be questions that could not be answered by answered and enforced by judges. And that changed in the 1970s. So during the Islamization wave in Pakistan in the 1970s, one thing that's interesting is that they took the provisions that used to be non-justiciable, that could not be enforced by courts, and the Constitution said that courts were henceforth allowed to interpret and apply them. So those are situations of political constitutionalism. Legal constitutionalism appears really in any country in which you have a constitution which requires compliance with Sharia, and you have constitutional courts that have the power to interpret and enforce the constitution, meaning they can exercise judicial review, and in which the courts have not abdicated their responsibility to interpret and apply the Sharia provisions. So the country that I've done the most work on is Egypt, which is a constitutional court that has a quite robust body of jurisprudence that in which the court reviews Egyptian laws for compliance with the Sharia, because the Egyptian constitution requires state laws to respect Sharia principles. But there are other countries that also have robust bodies of jurisprudence. So the United Arab Emirates has a robust body of jurisprudence. The Pakistan is an enormously interesting body of court cases in which courts review laws for compliance with the Sharia. And I think we're going to see, you know, we're going to see more and more of those. As I said, in terms of hybrid constitutionalism, you know, I point to some examples of institutional mechanisms that seem to be inclining ever, you know, seem to be integrating in minor ways elements of political and legal constitutionalism. But this really is an avenue that hasn't been explored as much as I think it probably should be.
Yeah, Egypt was one of those cases that you brought up in the hybrid area, that it might be inching to it. And it's had a little bumpy history the past few years here. And I think the article that you wrote might have been before the coup. I'm not exactly sure when that was written, but discuss what's happening with Egypt in terms of it inching along toward hybrid constitutionalism.
Well, yeah, I mean that really was a moment in time that lasted a couple of weeks. I mean, it historically Egypt had been a classic case, and since the amendment of the Egyptian constitution in 1980 to include an explicit provision requiring that Egyptian law be consistent with the principles of the Islamic Sharia, as the constitution puts it. Since that time, Egypt's represented a pretty, or at least for decades, it represented a pretty clear example of legal constitutionalism. So if you thought that an Egyptian law was inconsistent with the principles of the Islamic Sharia, then, you know, if you followed certain mechanisms and you know, certain procedures were followed, then you could challenge that law before the Constitutional Court, and the Constitutional Court would review the law and come up with an opinion as to whether the law is consistent with the Islamic Sharia or not, the principles of the Islamic Sharia. And if it found there was inconsistency, the court would strike down the law, right? The interpretation that the Constitutional Court in Egypt developed was an extremely liberal one. As far as the court was concerned, not only were Islamic principles not inconsistent with liberal principles, they were, in fact, highly supportive of them. And so the Islamic jurisprudence that developed in the Egyptian Constitutional Court for a series of decades was one in which Islam was cited in order to promote quite liberal outcomes that many Muslims disagreed with. So you did have conservative Muslims in Egypt who were not comfortable with the interpretation of Islam that was informing the Egyptian Constitutional Court's rulings. After democratization, after the Arab Spring, with the rise to power of the Muslim Brotherhood, which had among its members and among its politically important members a number of people who disagreed with the Constitutional Court's interpretation of Islam, you began to get a moment at which people began to try and think about how could they develop a system in which Egypt continued to respect, or at least promise to respect, the principles of the Islamic Sharia, while at the same time changing what the official interpretation, the court's understanding of what the Sharia required. And this was a difficult debate. Do you fire all the judges who sat on the court since they'd all been appointed by a former dictator? That didn't seem like a really good idea because the court actually was very well respected by the Egyptian people, and the court had often stood up to the dictatorship of President Mubarak. And so it had a certain legitimacy that people didn't want to threaten. But if you weren't going to get rid of all the judges and change the judges, well, how are you going to change their interpretation? And one set of parliamentarians suggested that perhaps you should move to a situation in which the parliament could override a judicial decision on a question of Sharia, or simply the parliament could override judicial decisions. That would have been a classic case of weak judicial review. Now, the court, as you can imagine, was not enthusiastic about that. And perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, shortly after that proposal was made, the Egyptian Constitutional Court declared that the law under which the new parliament had been elected was unconstitutional and invalid, and it dissolved the parliament. So the parliamentarians who had suggested that maybe the parliament could override a court decision, as they can, for example, in Canada, they lost their job, and they have never they've never come back since. So that's just, that's one of these moments at which you had a proposal that was made at a particularly sensitive political time, at a particularly fraught moment, and it, for a whole host of reasons, some probably good, didn't go forward. But it does remind us that there are going to be, there are going to be moments at which there are going to be political pressures in which courts have gone so far out of whack with the popular understanding of what a religion requires that you may end up either delegitimizing the court or delegitimizing the state, unless you can come up with some way to reconcile the two.
And so that kind of brings me to the current events issue that we had talked about early on about Turkey. And again, things are very fluid there, so who knows what's going to happen between August 11th when we're recording this and later in August when we will actually be airing it. But what are your thoughts on what is going on there with relation to the issue of Sharia-guaranteed clauses and perhaps what went on in Egypt and such? Are there parallels that we can draw, or are they very different cases?
They're really different cases. I mean, as I said, in Turkey not only doesn't have a Sharia-guaranteed clause, it has a clause requiring the state to respect secular principles, which would almost seem to suggest that state not only does the state not have an obligation constantly to think about, is my behavior consistent with Islamic understandings of ethics and of God's will, but in a radically secular governmental structure, it's actually fundamentally illegitimate to think about it at all. This is just supposed to be irrelevant to government behavior. So the Constitutional Court in Turkey has never been empowered to inquire into the consistency of Turkish governmental behavior with Islamic principles. Quite to the contrary, it's suggested that not only is it not its business, but the government shouldn't be thinking about Islam at all. People can vote their conscience however they want, but when the government acts, it acts in a secular way. So we're really not seeing that. And I haven't seen any indication, although President Erdogan comes from a traditionally pious background, and a lot of his political supporters were from the traditionally pious elements of society, I have never seen any suggestion that he would even contemplate proposing that a Sharia guarantee clause be put into the Turkish constitution. I think the assumption is, and one has to remember, in a democracy, if people are voting their conscience and they're all Muslims, then Islamic principles are going to come, you know, be respected. And what the state doesn't have to formally embrace something. It simply is going to come to reflect the essentially Muslim nature of its people. And Turkey seems to be perfectly comfortable with that. Okay.
Good thoughts on that. I'm going to finish up with one question I always like to ask our scholars on the program. You've had the opportunity to study this Sharia law for a long period of time. You're a PhD in religion. You have a law degree, also practicing law here in the United States, and you teach U.S. constitutional law. Have you ever thought about how your studies of Sharia law have impacted the way that you understand American constitutional law?
Yeah, I think about it all the time. I remember when I was clerking for I used to have this conversation sometimes with then Judge Alito when I was talking with him, but also with people that I was that I practiced with. I found it deeply enriching for a whole lot of reasons. One is, as I said, that Islamic legal thinking is enormously sophisticated. You know, the Islamic jurists, they didn't goof around. This isn't something where, you know, you just sort of read a statute and try and, you know, make it come out the way you want. Your eternal salvation is at stake. And the degree of care that they took when interpreting language, the degree of care that they took when thinking about whether a rule that applied in the past should be applied in the present, and if so, how. The sophistication with which they dealt with this issue is stunning. And there are any number of times in which I've felt that my ability to draw an analogy is much enriched by the fact that I read treatises on analogy written 1,000 years ago in the Middle East. So that's one. The other is the degree to which Muslim scholars grappled with the challenge of promoting both cohesion and diversity, that they struggled with a way to come up with a religion that had principles that were commonly accepted and allowed for a sense of identity and meaningful communal cooperation, while at the same time promoting robust contest and argument about how those principles should be applied in the best possible way. I've found that enormously inspiring. There are all sorts of times in which in Muslim societies have lapsed into despotism or authoritarianism, but there's a bedrock commitment to the idea of diversity and open contest about ideas that is I find extremely moving, and it's something that I sort of, you know, carry with me as I think about how Western societies have really more recently than Muslim societies begun to try and embrace the same principle. I mean, remember there was no Pope in medieval Muslim society, and as we start debating in the U.S. and in the West, how is it that we can create meaningful senses of national identity while at the same time promoting diversity, I think that being able to reflect upon the millennial-long struggles of Muslims to grapple with these questions is also very helpful.
Definitely worth thinking about. My guest today has been Clark Lombardi. Clark, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
It's a real pleasure, Tony. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.